IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Crowds of mourners attending a funeral ceremony in the Iranian capital for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated on Sunday. Household energy bills in Britain are set to surge by another 40% in October, deepening a cost-of-living crisis on average Britons. Also in the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson facing renewed accusations of lying after new photos emerge of him taking part at a party during the 2020 COVID lockdown. Welcome. Now, starting this news hour in the Iranian capital city, Tehran, where earlier today a funeral procession was held for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, who was assassinated on Sunday. Hundreds of mourners attended the event, many of them holding pictures of Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai, chanting slogans against the U.S. and Israel. Khodai was assassinated in his car just outside his home in an eastern Tehran neighborhood. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. The IRGC has called his killing an act of terrorism. Top Commander Major General Hossein Salami has pledged to avenge Khodai's assassination, said that the response will be tough and will make the enemies regret the heinous crime. Now, we've talked to political commentator Mustafa Pushesh for his take on the issue, and he explains why Iran is well within its legal rights to respond to the act of terrorism.
Well, definitely this is going to be responded. Some people might think that how about previous operations? Iran has always vowed to take revenge, and they might have questions if this has happened ever. Well, Iran and Iranian officials, especially the top military, are not in the habit of acknowledging responsibility for operations. And when you hear the Israelis claim responsibility, it's not their officials, but it's their media in order to escape responsibility, because this is a clear case of assassination and terror, and it should be condemned. The Israelis should be condemned for that. And when the UN fails, other countries fail to condemn and punish Israel, then according to the international rules and regulations, Iran has every right to take retaliation.
Activist and political commentator Sabaz Ruhollah Rezvi believes that Israel is threatened by Iran's growing regional influence, particularly in Palestine and Syria.
Israel is reacting, actually speaking. If you track the acts and the intelligence activities of Israel and the assassinations taking place in the last 2-3 years, you will clearly understand that Israel is trying to react to the presence of Iran, to the influence of Iran in the Syrian region, which is just next to the occupied Palestine. And the recent terror attack also, I think, should be analyzed in this paradigm. We have to know that this was, of course, on behalf of the Israeli media, they covered the event of the recent terror attack, and they themselves connected the event to the Syria. And it's very clear for everyone that this assassination had nothing to do with the Iranian nuclear program, nuclear energy program. It has nothing to do with that. It is clearly related to the Iran's presence at the region.
Now to Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, where rescuers are combing through the rubble of a collapsed building for survivors. At least 11 people are confirmed dead, and there are fears the number of casualties could rise, with reports saying that up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. 33 people have already been pulled from the 10-story building that came down on Monday. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road. The surrounding buildings have all been evacuated. Provincial governors saying that based on initial technical assessments, questionable construction practices are the leading cause of the tragedy. 10 people, including the mayor and several people involved in the construction of a major trade center, are in detention. The owner is said to have lost his life in the incident. Now let's listen to comments by President of Iranian Red Crescent Society about the ongoing rescue operations at the site.
Rescue teams are working to their fullest potential. Operations are in progress at a higher speed thanks to the deployment of more and better equipment to the area. We are trying to access the underground level to save those trapped there. All buildings in the vicinity of the collapsed structure have been evacuated to protect residents from potential risks.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has made a one-day visit to Amman on his fifth official foreign trip. The two sides discussed bilateral issues and signed a string of trade deals. The visit is said to have been in line with the Iran administration's policy of boosting cooperation with the regional states.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ibrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ibrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman.
Since taking office in August, President Raisi has stressed the need for a stronger trade and economic collaboration with Arab countries in the Persian Gulf. Now, his administration has already struck major agreements with Qatar, while trade delegates have been dispatched to UAE and Oman in recent months to explore enhanced economic ties. Meantime, Tehran has emphasized that regional states are capable of solving their problems by relying on their own resources and without foreign military or political intervention.
An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
Moving on, Iranian Foreign Ministry says that the U.S.'s open support for Tel Aviv has further emboldened the occupying regime. The ministry's spokesman, Said Khatibzadeh, says this has been worsened by international indifference to the regime's repeated acts of aggression against Syria. He condemned Israel's recent missile strikes on Damascus, saying that the regime's military is serving the air force of terrorist groups operating in Syria. Khatibzadeh says that Israel launches attacks whenever the Syrian army scores a victory against terror outfits. The spokesman also underlined the need for a strong response to Israel's acts of aggression, both on the battlefield and at the international level. On Friday, Israel launched a large-scale missile attack on Damascus, killing three people and razing buildings near a key mosque in the city. Now, taking a look at Europe, Britain's facing another jump in their power and energy bills, deepening the worst cost of living crisis the UK has seen since the 1950s. The Office of Energy Regulations, the UK, warning of a 40% surge in household energy bills in October. Ofgem Chief Jonathan Barley calls the price rise a, quote, once-in-a-generation event not seen since the oil crisis in the 1970s. He says the number of people in fuel poverty may double to 12 million. A household is in fuel poverty when it has to spend 10% or more of its disposable income on energy. The opposition Labour Party saying that this will cause enormous worry for families already facing soaring bills. Conditions at the global gas market have worsened since Russia launched a war in Ukraine, and the West targeted the Russian energy sector with sanctions. Also in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson facing new accusations of lying after photos emerge of him at a Downing Street party during the 2020 COVID lockdown. The photos obtained by ITV show Johnson raising a glass at a party with bottles of alcohol and food lying on the table. They also show eight people standing closer together. The party was held at a time when only two people from different households were allowed to mix indoors. Outside gathering was banned completely due to soaring COVID cases. The photos cast fresh doubt about a prime minister's claims that he was unaware of rule-breaking parties at Downing Street. Johnson told lawmakers in December 2021 that all guidelines were followed in his office. But later he apologized after a video emerged showing his senior aide joking about holding a Christmas party during the lockdown. Russia and Ukrainian forces are engaged in the heaviest fighting in eastern Ukraine as the war between the two neighbors grinds through its third month. According to Ukrainian authorities, Russia keeps bombing the twin cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in an attempt to control the Donbas region. The Ukrainian foreign minister has described the fighting as the largest battle on European soil since the Second World War. Russia says its forces have hit an arms depot in Donbas where mortar shells for U.S.-made howitzers were stored. The Russian defense minister, however, says Moscow is deliberately slowing its offensive to allow civilians to evacuate.
Ceasefires are being declared in humanitarian corridors created in order to get people out of settlements that are surrounded. Of course, this slows down the pace of the offensive, but this is done deliberately to avoid casualties among the civilian population.
Meantime, the Kremlin Express hoped to receive an Italian peace plan through diplomatic channels. Rome has presented a four-point plan to the UN Secretary General, According to Italian media, the first step in the plan is a ceasefire to allow civilian evacuations and demilitarization of the front lines. The initiative also calls for a bilateral agreement between Russia and Ukraine on the future of Crimea and Donbass. It also seeks a peace agreement between the European Union and Russia. Other news, the European Union is calling for talks with Russia on possibilities of reviving the exports of wheat and other food supplies from Ukraine.
I think this is a very complex topic, we also need in some way some dialogue with Russia on that one. It cannot be in Russia's interest that because of Russia, people are dying of hunger in the world. And therefore, I think we should first of all look at the dialogue with Russia, whether there is not an agreement that this wheat gets out of Ukraine.
The European Commission president stressed that food supplies from Ukraine are necessary to prevent a global food crisis. Kyiv says that Russia has blockaded all of its ports, a claim that Moscow has rejected. On Monday, the Kremlin blamed Ukraine for making its own commercial shipping impossible by placing mines along the Black Sea coast. Ukraine is one of the top wheat producers in the world. Kyiv says that its exports have fallen sharply since Russia launched a war on February the 24th. The war in the West's anti-Russia measures have pushed up price of food commodities in many countries. China and Russia have held a joint military exercise, sending their fighter jets over the Asia-Pacific region in an apparent show of might. Several jets participated in the maneuver and flew over the Sea of Japan, the East China Sea, and the Western Pacific on Tuesday. The Chinese Defense Ministry called a joint patrol part of its annual military drills. The ministry added that the exercise lasted 13 hours, involving several Russian and Chinese strategic bombers. It said, however, the Japanese and South Korean Air Force planes shadowed Russian and Chinese jets for part of the exercise. The maneuver came as both China and Russia remain at odds with the West, the U.S. in particular, over a host of issues. Moscow and Beijing are also opposed to what they called unilateral U.S. policies in Asia and Europe. The World Health Organization says that the outbreak of monkeypox in non-endemic countries is unusual but containable as more infections are reported. The UN Health Body says it will support member states with advice on how to tackle the situation. According to WHO data, more than 200 cases have been reported in Europe, Australia, and North America. The first infection was detected on May 7th in the UK, the latest country to confirm its first case in the Czech Republic. Monkeypox is similar to smallpox, and its symptoms include fever, headache, swelling of lymph nodes, and rash. The disease spreads through very close contact with an infected person. Monkeypox was first detected in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the 1970s. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the Imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the Imam's immediate liberation. The regime security and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Pishva near Varamin in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, "Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini," and "Death to the Shah." Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the Imam's house. The Imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, "The sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead," had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the Imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, "But at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm." Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, "On June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them." Lady Saqafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. "People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance." She continues, "Near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, 'Are you scared?' They said, 'We have heard so.' I said, 'It is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity, but not escape.' I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry. So I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Ishraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right."
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the present and future of Albania in a conversation with Albanian historian and author Olsi Yazici. But first, this brief analysis.
Albania is a small country we rarely hear about in the news.
One of the reasons for this is that the US decided to turn this southern Balkan state on the Adriatic coast into a base of operations against Russia and Muslim countries such as Iran and Turkey in the early 2000s. Beyond its geographic location, it is the fact that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population adhering to Islam, that made it a target for US domination. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, the US aggressively expanded its strategic presence into Eastern Europe and the Balkans, including into Albania. Albania had been ruled by the communist dictator Enver Hoxha for decades, who proclaimed Albania to be the first officially atheist state in the world, and who actively persecuted all religious activity. Despite this severe repression, Hoxha was not successful in extinguishing the religious beliefs of the Albanians, particularly the Muslim population. After the collapse of communist rule, Albanians revived religious life and re-established connections with their fellow Muslim brethren in the Muslim Ummah, particularly with Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. This caused an alarm in the United States and Europe, who feared the emergence of a majority Muslim country on the European continent with close strategic relations with the mentioned Muslim nations. A strategic campaign was initiated by the United States and its vassals to first strategically deny Albania to the Muslim world and to once again de-Islamize Albania, this time by using the excuse of fighting terrorism to ban all contacts between official Albanian Muslim organizations with any Muslim organizations from Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries. After the failure of the US-backed and Emirati-financed coup d'etat in Turkey against President Erdogan, the religious affairs of the Sunni Muslims in Albania was handed over to the pro-US and pro-Zionist Gulenist cult headquartered in the US state of Pennsylvania, a cult which played a key role in the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey. All Albanian Muslim clerics who opposed the imposition of the Gulenist cult on their country were persecuted, imprisoned, or exiled. The US also forced the Albanian government to accept the permanent encampment of the remnants of the Rajavi terrorist cult on its soil, a cult responsible for the murder of over 17,000 people in Iran since the 1970s, a terrorist cult that the Iraqi government expelled after the end of Saddam's rule because of its crimes against the Iraqi people during that era. Albania was forced to accept them after literally no other country in the world would accept them on their soil. The US strategic campaign for Albania also weaponized the legitimate feelings of Albanians and the Albanian majority population in neighboring Kosovo to turn that region into a base against Serbia and Russia. In pursuit of these strategies, the United States, through its embassy and through organizations such as the Soros Foundation, has captured and bought the Albanian political leadership, similar to the fashion it bought and captured elites in countries such as Ukraine. This puppet elite is committing the same crimes and abuses that other US-backed elites in other Muslim nations are committing, with the same result of turning the people against anyone and anything related to America. It appears the Albanian people are beginning to resist this US diktat and will eventually replace the current leadership controlled by the US with leaders who will re-establish relations with important Muslim nations in accordance with Albania's real national interests and the deep-held religious beliefs of its people.
Dr. Yazizis, thank you so much for joining us. You know, there's not many programs done on Albania. It's a relatively small country. It's one that maybe the big news organizations might not want to spend a lot of time on. It is also one of those countries which is very interestingly completely dominated by the West. A lot of stories going on there that if it was in any other country, it would be headline news. And yet we see that absolutely nothing is talked about it. And you've, of course, done a lot of interesting work on this in terms of the articles you've written and the research you've done. Also very brave of you to do this, given the situation that exists in Albania. You at the moment are not in Albania, maybe for good reasons also. So I think what's important is that we talk about Albania and maybe just get the facts out in the first instance to our viewers about what's really going on in Albania, which you will then lay out for us. And also then maybe spend a little time analyzing it, maybe more than just getting the information out, talking about why is it that it is the way it is, and what could be in the future. It's very interesting. You've described the leaders in Albania as our little Zelenskys, which is a very interesting but also very entertaining way of stating a fact that maybe we have an elite, we are dealing with an elite in Albania, which has been completely captured by the West and by the Americans. So if you could please, to start us off, give us a brief introduction into what's going on what's going on in Albania, what are the issues as far as you have been able to report them and talk to them about, and let us know what's going on in Albania for our viewers.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Albania is probably the oldest and the only fully recognized Muslim majority country in Europe. Albania was created as a country in 1913, after the First Balkan War, when the powers of Europe did not know what to do with the Muslims of Europe. But from the moment that Albania was created, it was an experimental state. Albania was not allowed to be a Muslim country, even though we are majority Muslim. We were cut from the rest of the Muslim Ummah. We were secularized. Islam was removed, and Albania was treated as an Italian colony until Second World War. After the Second World War, Albania became part of the Soviet Union. We were an independent country. We were a country that supported Palestine, supported the Islamic Revolution of Iran, even though the country was atheist and Stalinist. The ruler of Albania, Enver Hoxha, praised Imam Khomeini as a great revolutionary and leader of the Muslim world. And Albania played a very important role on denouncing American and Israeli imperialism in the Middle East. But what happened in Albania in 1991, with the fall of the Soviet Union, we had a regime change. And the Americans removed the communist government that we had, and they promised that they will bring democracy to us. Nevertheless, what happened after the first decade of 1990s, in 2000, when American foreign policy towards the world of Islam changed, American policies towards Albania changed as well. While in 1990s, Albania enjoyed freedom, democracy, and in a way, country was re-Islamized. Muslims, people like me, because we were not allowed to keep Muslim names during time of communism, so we discovered our Islamic roots. Countries like Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia came and helped the Muslim community to revive itself. Nevertheless, starting from the year 2000 and onwards, the Americans, and in particular the Soros Foundation, they intervened in our local democracy. We had a civil war in 96, 97 in the country. And from that moment, they brought to power the ex-communists who were socialists. Together with them, they brought Edi Rama to power, the person who now is our prime minister, who was a close friend of George Soros and the international bankers, friends of Soros. Now, after the coming of Rama to power, he came together with Fatos Nano in the year 2000s, and then he came back to power in 2014. The governments that have been formed in Albania under the ruling Socialist Party of Edi Rama, they have been dominated by U.S. Embassy and Soros Foundation. So if you know Albanian politics, most ministers that we have, the evangelical and Zionist mayor of Tirana, Erion Veliaj, they are all handpicked by the U.S. Embassy in Tirana, and they are byproduct of Soros Foundation. So why I call them Zelenskys? I call them Zelenskys because at the same way as the Americans and Soros and other Zionist bankers installed to power a clone like Vladimir Zelensky, the same thing the Americans have done in Albania, but not only, even in Kosovo, in Macedonia, in Montenegro, and many countries in the Balkans. So we in Eastern Europe, we don't have a democracy anymore for somebody to elect it, to be elected as a member of parliament in Albania, but in Kosovo as well. Your name have to pass through U.S. Embassy or Soros Foundation. So what has happened to us in Eastern Europe, and in particular in Albania, since the year 2000 and onward, we have undergone a massive change into our system. Number one, what the Americans have done with us in Eastern Europe, they have destroyed democracy. Number two is they destroyed the socialist economy that we had. In time of communism, we in Eastern Europe, we enjoyed free housing provided by the state, free healthcare, free education. But especially since 2014, when Edi Rama took power as a prime minister in our country, he have destroyed the social health welfare of our state. We no longer have free healthcare in the country, no longer we have a free university education. And moreover, people like our Prime Minister Edi Rama, who has been a member of Soros Foundation, and his wife, Linda Rama, she has been the director-in-chief of Soros Foundation in Albania. The strategy that Americans have followed from Albania to Ukraine is debt entrapment. So what they do is they have put our countries from Ukraine to Albania into huge debts, mm-hmm. and as a result, they are increasing prices. So if, let us say, in Albania, 10 or 20 years ago, we paid for our water bill in a month probably $3 to $4. Nowadays, an average Albanian citizen pays like $20 a month. What is happening is that countries like Ukraine or Albania have been enslaved by international bankers, people whom the Soros Mafia brings along, and they use a strategy of, number one, destruction of our local economies, imposition of their puppets into power, and imposition of the policies that Soros and Washington wants people in Eastern Europe to follow.
Dr. Yazici, let's talk a little bit about some of these policies, because we know, let's give it some substance and meat in terms of what's going on there. Why don't we start, maybe if you could explain for us, how they were able to hand the entire religious, the Muslim part of the religious life in Albania to the Gulenist cult, one that was unsuccessful. They tried to do it in Turkey to make to turn Turkey into this base for this, what we would in Iran call American Islam. And they were unsuccessful in Turkey with the policies that the Erdogan government took there and the arrests that they made after the coup d'etat. But what they ended up doing is they handed Albania to the Gulenists. So if you could talk about that, and also if you could talk about, which is maybe more important for us in Iran, is how is it that the Rajavi terrorist cult, which was, you know, in Iraq
and is currently also in Paris. The leadership is in Paris. But the people that were brainwashed into this cult that lived in Iraq for 40 years, how is it that they've ended up in Albania now? Why Albania?
Well, the history of Islam in Albania is complicated. During time of communism, Albania was declared an atheist state. In 1990s, when democracy came, Albanians embraced Islam again. Majority of Albanians are Sunni Muslims, but a large group of Bektashi Muslims exist. And the Bektashis, they are Shia Ithna Ashari Sufi sect. And in 1990s and in early 2000, Albanian Muslims established bridges with the Muslim Ummah, with countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and in particular Turkey and Iran. The bridges that Muslims of Albania built with the Muslim Ummah worried the Americans a lot. And in the 2000s, when Bush declared his global war on terror, which was a war on Islam, the Americans started a project in Albania to take control of the Muslim community of Albania. The Muslim community of Albania is the state institution, like in Iran, you have the Seminary of Qom, which manages Islam. From 2003 to 2005, I have been advisor to the Chief Mufti of Albania, and I have witnessed firsthand how the Americans, by using the anti-terror police of our country, removed from the structures of our Sunni Muslim community the clerics who were educated in the Arab world, but even in Turkey. There was a project which the Albanian and the American government coordinated together, which aimed to give control of Islam in Albania to the Gulenist sect. The Gulenist sect were brought in Albania for a number of reasons. First, they were brought as a pilot project in order to fight the revolutionary Islam, which started to grow in Albania in early 2000. By revolutionary Islam, I mean Muslims who were sympathetic to policies of Turkey and Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East. The Americans do not want a revolutionary Islam to exist in Europe, and in particular in Albania, which is the only Muslim-majority country after Kosovo in Europe. So what they did is they brought the Gulenist in the structure of the Muslim community, and they gave to the Gulenist control over the madrasas and the only Islamic university that we have in Albania, Badr University. I have written several articles for the Yearbook of Muslims in Europe, where I analyzed Islam in Albania. And the declarations that many Albanian politicians have done in years show that the US embassy instructed our leaders in early 2000 to remove through illegal forms the clerics from the structures of the Muslim community who were educated in Arab countries or even in Turkey. I'm talking here about the Sunni Muslims.
That's right.
And to replace them with the Gulenists. Now, when in 2016 we had the coup d'etat in Turkey against the democratically elected government of Erdogan, and from this moment onward, but even before that, Turkey was very concerned about the presence of the Gulenists. Now, I have to explain to your viewers that the present ambassador, U.S. ambassador in Albania, Yuri Kim, she was a close friend to Osman Kavala, one of the people who is jailed in Turkey, accused of organizing the coup. So, especially after 2016, Albania has become a base of the Gulenists, and the American ambassador is one of the chief persons who in a way, coordinated the coup against democracy in Turkey. And in this moment that we are speaking, there are many protests in Albania by Muslim clerics who want to have their position in the Muslim community, but they are not allowed. The elections in our Muslim community, whenever we have, they are done under the supervision of the U.S. Embassy and anti-terror police. So clerics who are educated in Sunni countries like Malaysia, Turkey, or the Arab world, they are not allowed to enter into this institution. So imagine if the Americans would have done this to Iran, to force a sect in Qom, and to prohibit other clerics from having access.
They actually tried to do that during the Shah, but of course they were not successful. So,
yes.
Also then please explain to us, because we have an actual terrorist cult organization now that is in Albania. Again, for us in Iran, very important, because they killed 17,000 people in Iran, which is the Rajavi cult that used to be in Iraq. And when the Saddam regime was overthrown by the U.S., they end up in Albania. How did that happen? If you could give us a little background on them coming to Albania. And by the way, sorry, doctor, we have to also mention a lot of these people are brainwashed, because what ended up happening is a lot of them, when they got off the plane or when they were when they arrived in Albania, they actually defected. They ran away because it was the first time that they were allowed to leave that encampment that they had lived in for decades in Iraq. They weren't even allowed to leave that encampment in Iraq during the decades that they lived there. So the minute they got off the plane or the minute they entered Albania, approximately half of them, this is what the media was reporting, approximately half of them actually fled from that cult and sought asylum in different parts of Europe.
Yeah, you are correct. Rajavi cult was brought in Albania. They started to come since 2013. At first, the Americans brought them to Albania under the excuse that they had to bring only some of their leaders. But then the bulk of this cult was brought under the Obama administration, and it was the Secretary of State John Kerry who came to Albania and brought 3,000 of them. The Americans had big problem with Iraq, because Iraqis knew very well who the Rajavi cult were, and they have committed many crimes against the people of Iraq.
That's
and
right.
They were looking for a safe haven for these terrorists. They tried to send these terrorists in many countries. They approached Macedonia, Romania, probably even Ukraine, but many countries of Eastern Europe simply refused to host these terrorists. So they brought them to Albania. Now, the question that many international scholars ask is, why Albania? The reason is simple. The Albanian government is a mafia government. For people who know local Albanian politics, most of our politicians, we have even government ministers, are drug dealers and who involve themselves in drug trafficking.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.